Football Pyramid podcast, where three lads discuss all things the English football pyramid. On today's episode, what is going on at Chelsea with half the squad exiled from the first team? Why has nobody signed Ivan Toney yet? Is the gap widening versus the big teams in the Premier League? We'll have a roundup of the key EFL stories across the season so far. We'll finish with a YTFC update from Loro, including a midweek win versus Ebbsfleet and a weekend visit to Gateshead. I'm your host, Alex Murphy, and once again, I'm joined by Tom Gallagher and Tom Lawrence. Boys, I want to start at Stamford Bridge and the current going on at Chelsea. So as I said, they've exiled half the squad away from first team duties, most notably Raheem Sterling, Ben Chilwell, Trevor Chalobah. They've treated a homegrown academy boy in Conor Gallagher like absolute rubbish, leaving him in airports, leaving him in limbo until he finally got his move to Atletico Madrid. Laura, have they completely lost the plot as a football club?
Well, I don't really know, because like the guys that are running it, Bowley and Co., these are like billionaires, aren't they? They obviously know what they're doing. But then on the flip side of things, they've never dealt in English football before. And from what I can understand, the recruitment policy is completely different to how they've treated maybe sports clubs in America. So it's really difficult to understand. I actually think Conor Gallagher's got a good move. I think he's upgraded. Atletico are a good side with a fantastic manager. He's going to play Champions League football and compete probably for titles or in the upper echelons of the La Liga. So I wouldn't be too worried if I was Gallagher. But it seems, and Tomo will probably have a better idea than this, but the likes of Sterling and Chilwell, maybe the players that were signed on or away from the financial kind of plan now on big money, they're trying to get rid of, and they're obviously trying to keep with players and make signings on these sort of longer contracts and less money, which I believe is the model now. But I mean, it sounds like a mess, doesn't it? I mean, I wasn't a fan of Raheem Sterling's camp coming out an hour before the Man City game and saying that they were expecting to play and making a big circus out of that. But at the same time, it sounds like there's been one thing said 1 minute and something else the next, and that's never good. Less surprised about the likes of Ben Chilwell being bombed off, but there's always a bomb squad generally in most football teams with players out of favour, but to have half the team in it is ridiculous. And at the moment, there's probably good odds on the bomb squad beating the first team. So yes, I think you've got to say there's a bit of a mess there. Even bringing in players, it feels like they can't buy a player, sell a player without buying one. João Felix has come the other way, who is flattered to deceive, hasn't he, since his move into La Liga from Portugal. I know he did a little bit last time in the Premier League, but you certainly wouldn't say that's going to upgrade Chelsea's squad too much. Pedro Neto, I think, has taken Raheem Sterling's number, a great player, but his figures are actually much lower than you'd expect, and he's always injured. So it's very difficult to know what's going on, but I just keep thinking in my head, these are decisions and a model and a business plan being put in place by people that have made billions in the past. So there must be a method to the madness, but as a football fan, I'd absolutely hate to be a Chelsea one at the minute.
Tomo, I put a screenshot in our chat about the Maresca quotes about sort of him exiling half of the squad. And I said I weren't particularly impressed with him, but you did come back with a valid point, which is, what do you want him to do in that situation? Do you think he's regretting taking that Chelsea job? Do you think he's just seeing it as a really good and big challenge for him? Like, where would you be if you were Maresca?
I don't think he's regretting his decision to take the job at all. I do think these decisions to exile Sterling, the likes of Sterling, Chalobah, Lukaku and Chilwell, and these guys, even Carney Chukwuemeka, they're all on massive money, and you wouldn't put it past the hierarchy just to give Enzo Maresca a bit of a nudge and just say, look, these guys don't fit into the model and our financial model any longer. Like, Ben Chilwell's on 200 grand a week. Raheem Sterling, 350 grand a week. Lukaku, 350 grand a week. Carney Chukwuemeka, who is essentially a youngster, a squad player, he's on 115 grand a week. Now, if you take into consideration their quite clear financial plan at the minute, their highest earners in that plan are Enzo Fernandez, Moises Caicedo and Cole Palmer. And they're all on 125 grand a week. Long-term contracts, but that's all they're on. So if you take all that into consideration, actually putting them out to pastures new, trying to shift those players on, isn't overly concerning if I was a Chelsea fan, especially when you consider Sterling's not really done it. Lukaku's a bad egg, never done it. Chilwell, injury prone, not really pushed on, has he, since he's moved to Chelsea? No. And then that Carney Chukwuemeka looks like he's injury prone as well. I know he's only a youngster, so maybe a tad harsh. And then you look at the likes of Trevor Chalabar and Conor Gallagher, homegrown talents. I know it does seem harsh to treat the players that way, but Chelsea are in a bit of a difficult position with Conor Gallagher because he only had 1 year left on his contract. So, and they offered him a new 2 year contract and he rejected it. So you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't in that scenario. I do think the only thing I will say, and I do think it's a little bit of a circus in the fact that how has this all come out the day of the first game of the season? Why is Raheem Sterling playing all pre-season? Like, they put them all these players in the bomb squad. No club is going to want to pay any fees for them. They've made it that clear that they need to get them off the wages. So if you're like the likes of Ben Chilwell, who's apparently been offered to Man United could just come along and say, yeah, we'll have him, but we're not paying a fee for him. If you want to get rid of him that badly, and similar to Raheem Sterling, who apparently wants to stay in the Premier League, if you like West Ham or Crystal Palace or Fulham or whoever want to take him on loan, no one's going to want to pay a fee for him. And they know that he's on that amount of wages. So in terms of kind of like the practicalities of set like shifting these players on, it's not great strategy, but they've just got a bloated squad and they do need to get rid of the players. And I do feel a little bit sorry for Enzo because, like you just said, he's just answering questions in a press conference. And what's he like? And to be honest, he's just being brutally honest. And quite often, players, they say in the interviews, that's all they want from their coach. So I think the only questionable thing is the timing. Why is it taken until the first day of the Premier League season for it to all come out and for it to all come out in the wash?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure all these decisions are Maresca's, though. I think we're sort of seeing why Enzo Maresca's got the job. I think he's sort of very compliant in towing the company line. You're telling me that he doesn't want Raheem Sterling, but he does want Kieran Dewsbury-Hall. Like, I don't think these are necessarily footballing decisions. They're more based on the sort of financial model. And probably another reason why Pochettino left last season, because he was doing a hell of a job towards the end of the season. Like you say, Tigo, they were trending and they were looking good. And some of the quality they got out of some of the players, I mean, he turned Nicholas Jackson into, I thought, a really poor striker and into an okay one, and Cole Palmer into a world beater. So the only reason for him to leave is if he was on a completely different page to the hierarchy, which I think we're seeing play out now. In Enzo Maresca. And that shows, that sort of reflects again in the fact that Raheem Sterling was playing all summer. Clearly, it looked like in Maresca's plans. And then I think he's been given a nudge, like one of you just said, and he's been told, no, these lot are in the bomb squad. Like I said, nothing wrong with having a bomb squad, but the size of it just shows the calamity of the situation, I think, at the moment. It'd be interesting to see, like Chilwell and Sterling in particular, where they go next. Because these are sort of big players used to being at big clubs and internationals. And we're coming towards the end of the window where most teams have got their cards in or their decks in order. So it might be a weird loan to West Ham for one of them and a stint at Crystal Palace. And then all of a sudden you're staring down the barrel of mid-table Premier League football. But that's football for you.
Before you move on, or before you ask another question, like the likes of like Axel Di Sassi are apparently up for sale. And they only bought him last year. So, like, the strategy and the sort of the financial strategy behind the squad planning just seems muddled and completely fucked, for lack of a better word. But then you can spin it and say, well, have they just signed Axel Di Sassi, realised they've made a mistake and they're so rich they can just think, oh, well, we made a mistake. Let's not double down and triple down. Let's just sell it. So I don't know. It strikes me as, look, that you won't be able to fully judge this Todd Bowley era of Chelsea ownership until maybe 3-4 years, because most of the players they're buying won't come into their prime for another 3 or 4 years.
It feels like you're right, though, Tommy, that a lot of the kind of mainstream media around Chelsea this week's been that it's like utter chaos and a circus, which it probably is. But actually, if they're just saying, look, hands up, we've made mistakes with our signings, we're going to create this bomb squad, which, by the way, is that like a well-used term, bomb squad, or have we just coined it on this pod?
No, they use it on Under the Cosh all the time.
Oh, okay. All right. So I was just picturing Deontay Wilder in a suit, like trying to get Chilwell up the left flank. But no, okay, if it's widely used, that's fine. But if they've got this bomb squad there and they are saying, look, we're not just going to keep you, we're now going to look to get rid of you, then maybe they are just, you know, learning on the job. It feels like that's what Bowley's doing with football, is learning as he goes, and he's going to make very, very expensive mistakes, as we're starting to see.
Well,
if you think of Todd Bowley's first summer, he basically let Thomas Tuchel like take the reins, and I think they signed Kalidou Koulibaly, Raheem Sterling, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, all very expensive, quite old players, like expensive mistakes. I even think Carney Chukwuemeka was in that group as well, who's obviously on massive wages. So they made horrendous errors in their first summer, and it's almost set them back a couple years, and they're just paying the price for it now a little bit.
Yeah. One thing I will say, just so we're not just bashing Chelsea, is I actually thought, I know it was against Man City and the result wasn't there, but the starting 11 that they put out actually looked like a really well-balanced team, I thought. And I think there's a lot of Chelsea fans looking at that starting 11 thinking that actually might be our best team. I mean, we had Caicedo, Lavia and Enzo in midfield. They looked like they had quite a lot of threat going forward, and Kunku Jackson and Palmer. Cucurella has obviously had an annoying but fantastic summer. So I actually think on paper, their team looked quite good lining up against City on Sunday. And I think that it will have a bit. But obviously, having the backdrop of Zibom squad and all the other things, it's not going to be conducive to pushing on for top four, in my opinion.
Yeah, just one final point on that bomb squad as well before we move on, is that it's all well and good exiling these players and saying we need you to leave the club. But, you know, United have seen firsthand how difficult it is to offload players who are on inflated wages, who are quite cushy. Raheem Sterling's on 350 grand a week. To get another Premier League club at this stage of the season, he's probably going to have to take a 200 grand a week pay cut. Someone might give him 100 grand, 150 a week to sign him. But at 29, why would he do that?
He's got 3 years left on that contract. And I think someone on TalkSport said the other day that essentially he's got about 60, 65 million quids worth of contract left with Chelsea. So what, like, if you're Raheem Sterling, why would you give up any of that money? And there are reports this morning saying that he wants to go on a permanent deal as opposed to a loan. But I just can't see. No one wants to pay a fee for him because he's on that massive wages. And because obviously Chelsea have made it clear that he needs to go. And why would anyone pay those wages? It's because he's actually not been that good, is he, for the last 2 years?
But that's the whole point of bomb squads, trying to get players to go that are under contract. Do you know what I mean? They try and make their lives as miserable as possible. Sticking them in with the reserves, making them come in at weird hours, trying to find any reason to fine them or maybe lure them into a mistake to be able to sack them or whatever. But the whole point of the bomb squad is to try and make these players' lives more ugly, I guess, so that they want to move on rather than just sitting there and taking the money for the next 3 years, which would be tempting if it was 65 million, I suppose.
Yeah, if you like played for Rotherham and you were being made to train with the under-18s and you're on 1,500 quid a week and you're getting changed in porter cabins and all of that sort of thing, I can see why you'd go on and want to start playing football again. But Raheem Sterling, 29, retired from international duty, won loads of stuff with City, doesn't have to prove anything to anyone now, owed 65 million in his contract. He's probably thinking, I'll have a bit of this. If you don't want to play me, I'll hang fire. Because ultimately, he's playing a game of poker with them, isn't he? How much are you willing to pay off of my contract to get me off the books? How much of that loss are you willing to take? Because if you don't want to pay out my contract, I'll just let it run down, which isn't going to happen. He won't sit there for 3 years. But that's ultimately what's happening now, isn't it? Games of poker with those players.
I would quite like it. And I know in the long run, Raheem Sterling sitting as an old, like 60, 70-year-old man talking about his career to his grandkids, he probably won't want to hear this, but I would love to see him just sit out his contract for 3 years and just make Chelsea pay 65 million. Do you know what I mean? And like, imagine that is basically just getting paid $65 million to sit at home, or just to be like, just to be fit and go to the gym every day. Not a bad life, is it? If you want it, but obviously he's an elite level athlete, and he's nothing like us, and he won't want to do that. And he's also a very rich man already.
Yeah, and that's a very important point. Let's not discredit the fact he's an absolute top athlete, like, and pro, like, in regards to what he's achieved, and he'll want to play football, but it's game of poker, I think. So yeah, we'll see over the remainder of the transfer window what Chelsea do. I wouldn't rule out them bringing more people in. Obviously, João Felix has come in. I see them being linked with the striker at Napoli now that Lukaku's going the other way. So we'll see if they've got any more money to spend, Chelsea. One striker who currently hasn't got a new club but was left out at the weekend, and the manager was very honest, Thomas Frank, and said, look, Big Ive's got options, nothing sorted at the minute, but he's not currently playing while he's trying to sort a move. But Tomo, why do you think that Ivan Toney's not already secured a new club? He's a proven Prem goal scorer. I know he had time out for his betting ban, but proven Prem goal scorer. He's probably in the prime of his career. I think everyone agreed that he did well at the Euros when he got the time given. It feels to me that with 1 year left, there's potentially a bargain there to be had for a Premier League side.
Yeah, you say that, but there's a couple sort of main reasons, I think, why he hasn't secured himself a big Premier League move to a couple of the big clubs. And one basically being Brentford's demands. I think earlier in the summer, they were saying 60, 65 million for him. When you consider he's 28 years old, only got 1 year left on his contract, you take into consideration the betting ban and a couple of, like, and I know this makes me sound like a bit of a dick, but a couple of character defaults that makes him seem like not the consummate professional. Might be a tad harsh, that analysis. But when you take into consideration that, and then you also take in consideration his reported wage demands, which are 200, 250 grand a week. Now, if you're a Arsenal or a Man United or a Chelsea, who are the most likely big Premier League clubs to come in for him, who obviously need another striker, are they going to pay 200 grand a week, 250 grand a week to a player who, yes, he's a very good, proven Premier League player. Yes, he scored 20 goals in the season before last. But is he going to be their star striker? Maybe not. So then you look at, he's probably going to be a squad player. And for those types of wages, are you going to pay that? Probably not. So then that's when, I guess, the clubs in Saudi Arabia come into the fold, and the Al-Ahly, who have apparently offered him a 3-year contract worth 16, 17 million a year. Premier League clubs can't compete with that when you consider the fact that they'll probably put him on 100, 150 grand a week, and he won't potentially be a massive starter. So yeah, there's a couple of reasons, but it is strange. And I would say another reason actually is he's only got 1 year left on his contract. So what, like, if you're a Arsenal, why not just wait a year, get him for free next year? Or if you're a Man United, why not wait a year, get him for free next year? It's not, he doesn't seem like that be all and end all type signing where you desperately need him right now. So they're the main three reasons, I guess.
Laurie, do you think if you were an Arsenal where they've potentially said about the need for a centre forward, look, I know Havertz's form's picked up, they've got Jesus, but I think Jesus is a wide player myself. Do you think there's a deal to be had there? Do you think maybe some clubs are thinking, let's leave it till deadline day and test Brentford's resolve to try and get it for a bit cut price and try and get him in last minute?
Yeah, I'm not sure about Arsenal. I'm not sure Arteta sees it the same as most other people that they need a big centre forward in there. But I think Brentford leaving Ivan Toney out is kind of, at the weekend, is kind of saying, look, we need to sell him now. Because, like you say, he's got 1 year left on his contract. He could just stay there for a year, maybe not be as motivated. And we all know when players are out of contracts, they can ask for even more wages because they're not having to pay transfer fees. I just think it's a shame. Like, I want to see Ivan Toney in the Premier League. He came into it late. He worked his way up through the EFL. He didn't get into the Premier League until he was probably 26, 27. And to see him leave at 29 after having a bit of a cult hero summer with England, albeit didn't play loads, but gave a good account of himself in the minutes that he did get, and then in the penalty shootout. It'd be nice to see him get a move to a, not even, whether it's a big club or even just a club bigger than Brentford. So I'm surprised no one's in England has got that deal done, and I'm also surprised that Ivan Toney would consider going to Saudi Arabia at this point in his career. I think that's maybe one for 2 or 3 years down the line, if ever. But who am I to say someone should be turning down
millions
of pounds?
Yeah, just that point, I want to stick up for Ivan Toney a little bit, in the sense of, I agree with Laura completely. No one wants to see him go to Saudi, but really, he's only been a Premier League player for, what, 3 seasons? And he's been playing for Brentford, who don't pay notoriously massive wages. I think he's their highest paid player on maybe 60, 70 grand a week. Now, to us three, that's a hell of a lot of money. Like, it's ridiculous to even consider that not a lot of money. But when you consider he scored 20 goals in the season before last and has the ability to score 20 goals in the Premier League, those type of players are usually on 200, 250 grand a week. So when he's looking around and he's in the England squad and all those players are getting paid a hell of a lot more than him, and then he's not got the offers that he's wanted from Premier League clubs this summer, and then he gets that, what is it, £50 million contract on the table, and it's only 3 years from Saudi Arabia, it's almost impossible to turn down. And it's a hell of a lot easier to sit on a podcast and say, oh, don't go, I would never like play in Saudi Arabia. But then when the contract's on the table and it's 45 million quid, and okay, he's a very rich man as it is now, but 45 million quid is like, fuck you money, isn't it? It's like, my kids' kids are fine, their kids are fine, my cousins are fine, my granddad, everyone's fine. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, it's a shame that he's probably going to make that move, but can you blame him?
3-year deal only takes him to 31 as well. So if he plays well there and the money's still in Saudi at that time, there's potential another 3 years in it for him, isn't it? That would only take him to 34. You think about some of the ages players are playing to. I don't think he's massively reliant on his pace either, Big Ive. So I don't think losing that yard's going to affect him. I think he's a lot more physical type of player. So he could have many years out there and make absolute fortunes. But the other way to look at that is, that deal might still be there in 3 years' time. Do you want to challenge for the big honours in the Premier League? I got a sneaky suspicion a couple big teams in the Prem or a couple Prem teams are going to test Brentford's resolve in the final days of the window to try and get sort of given 30 mil for Ivan Toney.
Yeah. Just one, I do think sometimes we do think, oh, in 3 years that deal will be on the table. So what, like, why wouldn't he just wait? But really, like, how much does this sort of thinking come into a footballer's like brain? Like, Ivan Toney could go into training tomorrow and break his leg and his career could be over. Like, if the money's on the table now, you've just got to take it. So you can back yourself all you want and say, yeah, in 5 years I'll be an even better player and I'll get more money from Saudi. But like, freak accidents happen, and I know that's a little bit morbid to bring it up, but that must come in the minds of Ivan Toney, his family members, when they're all making this decision.
Yeah, I'm sure if you're Ivan Toney's granddad or cousins, you're definitely saying, get yourself out to Saudi, big man. You want some of that oil money. Well, we'll keep abreast of what Ivan Toney's up to in the final knockings of the transfer window. But as I say, I wouldn't be surprised if a Prem team tries to get a bargain in the final hours of the window. Whereas I just want to talk a little bit about the first game week in the Premier League. It's obviously very early days and only one game, but we saw comfortable wins for City against Chelsea. Arsenal and Liverpool both had comfortable wins as well. There are victories for Villa, United and even 10-man Newcastle. I think we can all agree Tottenham should have comfortably beat Leicester. Laura, are we starting to see a bit of an even bigger quality gap form in the Premier League top eight, do you think?
Yeah, probably. But I think it's better in some ways, because we used to talk about the Premier League in terms of the big four. And now, I mean, we were talking the other day about who's going to finish in the top eight. And it's really difficult because the likes of Newcastle and Aston Villa and Spurs and even West Ham, with the money they've spent, are big contenders now. So in terms of the competitiveness at the top end of the Premier League, it's better. But it does mean that there are more sides that are further away than the likes of the teams that are coming up, like your Ipswiches and your Southampton. So, yes, probably a bigger gulf. And I think that's all the more credit for the teams that come up and sustain their Premier League status, like your Brightons and your Brentfords over the last few years. And that's why the managers that have been at Brighton have gone on and got big jobs, and why Thomas Frank is probably in such high regard and will get a massive job one day, because it's a hell of a thing to get to the Premier League, but it's an even tougher one to stay there. And we're seeing that play out regularly now, aren't we? And we did again on the first day of the season. I mean, Southampton played most of the game against 10 men and still lost against Newcastle. And that's not even one of the teams you'd consider one of the big four in olden times. So Ipswich gave a good account of themselves, equipped themselves well, but the quality told. And probably, as we said last week on the pod, we're looking at all three teams really struggling to stay up. And if any of them do, it's probably only going to be one by the skin of their teeth.
So I think the nature of what Man City have done in the Prem as well over the last few years has means that the likes of Arsenal and Liverpool, who have obviously been their main challengers, have just got to win regardless. There's not much margin for error, is there? You can't lose too many games across a Premier League season. You think back to when United and Arsenal were fairly dominant. I think it was something around the 80-point mark or just above would win you the league. Now you're having to get closer to the 100 mark to keep pace.
Yeah, City are boring. City and the way they sort of controlled Chelsea, who actually I was quite impressed with, but the way they kind of held them at arm's length without Rodri, without a couple of players. And you look at Rodri, I think he's only returned to training this week. It felt a little bit like last weekend's opening game of the Premier League season. It felt a little bit like it was still pre-season to quite a lot of clubs. And they're just trying to get through these first couple of games to get their players up and running, like to get them fit and firing and like ready to perform brilliant. Like, because even though we're talking about United, Arsenal, Liverpool, Man City all winning, none of it was like, no one blew anyone away. Liverpool struggled in that first half against Ipswich. I know you'd expect Ipswich to come out hot, and it was a great atmosphere at Portman Road, but it wasn't. There was no sort of blow away. So no, the results of the weekend was a moment in time, wasn't it? But yeah, you're right. Look, Arsenal and Liverpool, they can't afford to slip up ever. And especially, I mean, I don't expect Liverpool to challenge Man City this year, but I do Arsenal. And I think Arsenal, the way the title race has happened over the last couple of years, feels like they probably need like a 10-12 point advantage at Christmas just to guarantee that they'll like, well, one, be in the title race, but be favourites for the title. Because if City are in touching distance, then it almost feels like they get a couple points just mentally. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they always seem to have the January to May just refuse to lose a game, which obviously is difficult to keep pace with. But looks like City only strengthening as well, bringing Gundogan back to the club from Barcelona. A bit of a weird one, that, but Barcelona let Gundogan leave on a free now, and he's straight back into City. I thought Kovacic was really good. I thought that was quite a funny one, that he, who left Chelsea relatively cheap, bossed the midfield alongside Bernardo, who kind of sat in deep, who wouldn't normally play there, against you, Enzo, Lavia, Saicedo, £250 million midfield.
Yeah, did you see that the Chelsea-Man City game, there was only one surviving member of the Chelsea Champions League winning team from 3 years ago, and that was Kovacic, who scored against Chelsea. I think that just about sums that up for Chelsea.
Yeah, it does. Boys, so got a couple nice fixtures at the weekend just to call out. Got Brighton versus United at 12:30 Saturday lunchtime. Obviously, United started with all three against Fulham, looked a little bit more assured and made some signings, and Brighton blew Everton away and looked like they've started the season off well. And then you got Villa versus Arsenal at 5:30 on Saturday. Again, another big game. Arsenal have had a difficult start, and so have West Ham to the season in regards to their fixtures. And that's quite a big game early on in the season, but excited to see how both of those play out.
And just quickly on that Villa-Arsenal game, I don't know if you boys seen this on Twitter. It went viral, an AFT clip. It was these two lads on Arsenal Fan TV, and they were arguing about who was the second best manager in the Premier League behind Pep Guardiola. And one was arguing for Unai Emery, the other was arguing for Mikel Arteta. So let me give the floor to you, Laura. Who do you reckon is the second best manager in the Premier League?
Arteta. Yeah, Arteta. And I don't think there's... you know, there's a lot of justification for to say Unai Emery, and I think it's more of an opinion based on what might be to come with Arteta. But I think what he's done with the Arsenal team, what that anyone at the club hasn't been able to do for the last 20 odd years has been nothing short of magnificent. And he's for anyone to even rival Man City for the last couple of years has been brilliant. And for most people to be tipping them to actually beat them to it this season, Unai Emery couldn't do it. So I think there's levels to this game, and I think Unai Emery's shown that he operates well at your Sevillas and your Aston Villas, whereas Mikel Arteta wouldn't surprise me if he's going to be Arsenal or maybe Real Madrid one day. So for me, it'd be Arteta.
Yeah, I completely agree, and it actually goes to show that sometimes you just stay away from Twitter comments, because I would say 99% of people on Twitter said Unai Emery because he's won all of the Europa Leagues, because he's won a couple titles, and I guess I know Mikel Arteta's won the FA Cup, but basically it's a stick to beat him with, isn't it? Even though he's done really well over the last two seasons and progressed that football club to Champions League every single season and to challenging for Man City, they still not got over the line. So it's easy to give Arteta a little bit of stick because of that. But yeah, I'd go Arteta as well. Easy.
I know managers ultimately get judged on silverware, but like one result the other way in the Premier League in the last couple of years and Arteta's maybe sat with two Premier League trophies. That's all the difference it was. And look, he hasn't got over the line, but ultimately that's a goal either way, not losing to Villa in the back end of last season as Arsenal, you know, maybe winning one of the games against City in a reverse fixture between Arsenal. But because he hasn't got over the line, you have people calling him a fraud, but it's like 3 points in it, one victory, and then he sat there with two trophies. It's just, well, I know it's a famous line on the pod, but fine margins.
Fine margins, indeed. When you look at the whole fraud debate around Gareth Southgate, and it's like, well, if Bukayo Saka sticks away that penalty, or if we don't concede that set piece goal, it was the first set piece goal that we conceded in about 2 years against Italy, then Gareth Southgate's a genius and he's won England's first trophy in 40, 50 years. And because the players missed the penalty, he's a fraud. It's ridiculous sometimes. The football commentary and football punditry, and I guess football fandom, it's ridiculous sometimes.
Indeed. Well, just to touch on the FPL as well, we obviously launched the Pyramid Podcast FPL. After the first week, a team called Demin FC are top on 92 points, which is an amazing haul from the first week. I did click on their team, however, and they went early in triple captain Salah. Some would say that's blowing your load early. Others would say it was a very good decision because he got a goal and assist and bonus points. I think he got 42 points for it.
Yeah, can I just say, I know I just stuck up for Mikel Arteta there and said he was the second best Premier League manager at the moment, but he is a fucking shithouse. Like, in his pre-match press conferences and in pre-season, he was bigging up Gabriel Jesus all the time, saying he's the best thing since sliced bread. I can't believe how fit he looks. He's the sharpest guy ever. I put him in my fantasy team. He comes on for 5 minutes and gets booked within 30 seconds for fingering a Wolves player, or actually, no, sorry, I'm mistaken. A Wolves player fingers him and he reacts by giving him a little push. So,
yeah,
fuck you, Arteta. Fuck you.
Yeah, I had Jesus in my team as well. He said he's looked an absolute beast pre-season. He's a different animal, going to score goals. And I was like, yeah, I'll have a bit of that at 7.5, 8 million, whatever he was. And then just asked the team when I was at Footy on Saturday and someone was like, yeah, Havertz. I was like, grand. Boys, so looking ahead to the next week, though, we have got Man City versus Ipswich, probably on paper the smallest team against the most dominant team. I haven't got Haaland in my team. Laura, I know you haven't, unless you've made a drastic change since the first game week. But Tomo, is that a triple captain option for the weekend?
Well, it is a triple captain option for the weekend. I won't be taking it, though, because it's just not that fun, is it? Second game week, you want to have triple captain for the double game weeks, don't you? And I know this day and age, those double game weeks, there's a lot of like, well, Haaland might not play both games. A lot like all of those kind of things going on. A lot of rotation. But yeah, I won't be doing it this week just because I don't think it's that fun. You've got 36 game weeks then not having triple captain.
I think that's why none of us ever win our FPL leagues, because we don't sort of just think rationally with stats in our head. We're just like, what's fun and what does your heart say? I fancy Isak to notch a brace at the weekend. It's like, yeah, but he's not going to, is he? Just go with the clear statistical choice.
Yeah, if you're serious about winning FPL, Haaland should be triple captain this week. That's the best the best player in the best fixture, home to Ipswich. But I pick my captain based on, like, I won't pick a captain if I can't watch the game. Like, if it's Tottenham Villa at 4 o'clock on Sunday, I'm having a Tottenham or a Villa player because I want to watch it. Do you know what I mean? You're right. It's like heart over head almost. The best players, I think, will have Haaland triple captain on Saturday, because I think there's meant to be less double game weeks this year. Obviously, the scrapping of the FA Cup replays and stuff like that. I think they're expecting less blanks and less doubles.
I think you guys are trying to fucking wind me up here and start and get on the triple captain, Tom.
No, I honestly don't. I think that the lads in our main league that we've got, the league with 40 people in that have got Haaland, the ones who look at the statistics and things like that will be like, as Lauro said, this is the best player against the smallest team in a home fixture. I'm triple captaining. I also think a few of them, I saw one of the FPL pages on Twitter say that a few people are going to triple captain who maybe wouldn't have because Salah outscored in the first game week, and that people will be thinking, right, this is an opportunity. So I think we'll see a high level of triple captaincy on him. So, Tomo, I won't put pressure on you, but yeah, I'd have a firm think about it.
Don't be a pussy.
Pretty much. Right, boys, let's move on to the EFL. And Laura, I want to start with Leeds. So, so close to going up last year. In the summer so far, you've lost Somerville, Kamara, Ruta and Gray. Obviously ripped the side apart a little bit. What do you think it means for the season ahead? Obviously no wins yet this season, out the Carabao Cup, which I know personally you don't care about. But is the money going to be reinvested? Are you worried about Leeds' chances of getting up after losing those players?
Yeah, we'll find out in the next week, won't we? I think all Leeds fans expected to lose Gray and Somerville, and we kind of accepted that. But to lose Rutter, Kamara Lesso, good player, but Kamara Lesso, but to lose Rutter with 10 days left of the transfer window, when we've already pocketed the best part of 80 million this summer, was a blow. So our season will hinge, as it did last year, on the final week of the transfer window and Daniel Farke's ability to embed those players and get a tune out of them again. I think it will be weaker. I know Burnley have started like a house on fire. I think they'll lose one or two more players and it will be weaker at the top end. There won't be a runaway like a Leicester, and there won't be a surprise pack like, or as strong as a surprise package as Ipswich. So I think it will be a smaller points tally to go up this season. I think our points would from last season will win the league this year. But to get there, we are going to have to reinvest some of the, 100 million that we've taken in the last couple of weeks. So all hinges on the next week, and that will probably coincide with the attitude of the Leeds fans, who are starting to turn a little bit, both on the 49ers and Red Bull kind of aspect, and also Daniel Farke a little bit, because don't forget we've played Portsmouth first game of the season, conceded 3 and drew, and we've looked very lacklustre going to West Brom. My worry is there's a week left and there could be more outgoing. Wilfred Nonto's probably looking around thinking, blimey. I mean, we didn't go up last season with Rutter and Somerville. They've gone. I'm staring down the barrel of another year in the Championship and we might not even go up. So there's scope to lose even more players. So at the moment, very concerning, but we've got time to turn that around and add to Bogle and Rothwell, who are decent additions, but nowhere near enough.
Just a quick point to almost stick up for the Leeds owners. That Rutter transfer was a release clause, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So Brighton come in, trigger the release clause. There's not a lot Leeds can do in terms of... And I actually think you'll probably know more than me, Lauro, but I do think the Leeds owners offered him a new contract, didn't they, to try and keep him. So And the player was basically just adamant, look, I'm going to Brighton. That's a much better project. It's in the Premier League, blah, blah, blah. So that one, I know it sort of is like the straw that breaks the camel's back as such, but it's tough to get on the back of the Leeds owners just for that one.
No, but I think that's why I'm not casting opinions on that just yet. But if 10 days go by, the transfer window shuts and we haven't invested any money in a suitable replacement for particularly Rutter, but also Somerville, and probably also someone else in midfield, then it's going to be a long 6 months before January. You can't sell £100 million worth of players and reinvest next to nothing. So we'll speak again in 10 days. We'll see what the results are like and we'll see what we've spent.
Did Rutter, did he play in like the 10 for you, Laura? Did he play behind a nine?
Yeah.
So he's like him... Go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, like, if you looked at it on a football pitch, he's a 10, but he's not like a... I always feel weird calling him a 10. He was more of a, like, he just did what he wanted and he was the best, I think, one of the best players in the Championship last season, if not the best. Somerville got all the credit, but the amount of assists that Rutter got and the way that he sort of turned defence into attack so quickly in the final third was just unbelievable. And when Brighton come in and pay £40 million for a player, you know they're good because Brighton don't miss, do they?
£40 million for a Championship player as well is like, that's like, I personally think it's a good deal all round. I know he's a very important player, Laurie, but £40 million for a Championship player is like unheard of.
Yeah. Yeah, but we bought him for about 35.
Yeah, right. But then he got relegated, and usually once you get relegated, your value goes down. But Leeds obviously put that in his contract for the release clause, and I think clearly that protected him a little bit because it is a good deal.
Yeah, I agree. Like, we've made £100 million on three players this summer. So far we've spent five on Jadon Bogle. So let's see a little bit more reinvested, and then maybe we can start singing the praises of Red Bull and 49ers or whoever's making the decisions. But precarious as it stands.
Yeah, and Murph, just before we move on to another point, I know I'm doing this in the middle of the podcast instead of the end of the podcast, and I know I'm going to sound like a beg here, but people who are listening to this, please give us a 5-star review. Please like our shit on Instagram and Twitter. Do all of the stuff. It's only a couple clicks. Actually, when it comes to like Spotify and Apple Podcasts, if you leave a 5-star review, a nice little comment, it catches the algorithm. It bumps us up the league table, and it makes this podcast even more popular. So I just wanted to say that before we move on to, I guess, League One.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. On the one hand, we're asking for 5-star reviews, and on the other hand, we're falsely accusing Gabriel Jesus of fingering someone. So let's make sure the quality's there before we're begging for reviews and whatnot from people. But yes, if you can forgive us on this occasion, I concur. Do what you can to help us.
Yeah. I completely bypassed that, actually, that we accused the Brazilian fan of that. You did correct yourself.
Yeah, but if someone switched off at that point, they'd go away thinking that Gabe Jesus is a little pervert.
Yeah, but actually he was really, really harshly booked for pushing someone who was prodding their bum with their finger. So, apologies to Gabby and his team. But yeah, if you can look past that, then any help you can give the pod is greatly appreciated. Boys, let's move on to League One, as Tomo says. And just want to touch on Stockport. Stockport are 2 wins from 2, scored 5 goals and none conceded in the league. Tomo, one player to call out as well, Louis Barry, famously has an episode named after him, formerly of Barcelona, playing really well for them.
Yeah, he's been a star player, hasn't he? And he's too good for League Two last year, probably too good for League One this year. But I almost kind of admire a player like that who basically goes to a club on loan. He's still at Aston Villa, so he's gone back to Stockport on loan, and he's almost putting his career above any sort of financial gains, etc. And he's putting his career development ahead of all of that. And because he knows he's going to play 38, 40 games, or basically every single minute that Stockport would have him last season. And the same goes for this season. So yeah, he's looked good. I think Loro will know more about this player than me, but they've got a player called Lewis Bate, who's a centre mid, who's been playing really well over the last couple of games. I think he's come from Leeds on a free transfer. He was in Chelsea's academy. He's obviously a very good player. And they've obviously got a couple other good goal scorers as well, because I think they've scored 5 in their first 2 games. But if you actually... And actually, to be fair, I think they've got Bristol Rovers at home this weekend, so I wouldn't put it past them to score, to put it, 3 wins out of 3 and 3 clean sheets out of 3 as well. But they're slightly overperforming their XG. So they've scored 5 goals, and I think their XG over the first 2 games is like 2.4. So you'd almost expect, and they've just got promoted, didn't they? So you'd expect them to sort of slowly move back to the mean. And obviously, it's a small sample size. It's only been 2 games. But Loro spoke a lot about Dave Chandler last season. He's obviously a very good manager, just gets promoted all the time with every single club. So it's a really encouraging start for them. And also, another thing I'd like to say is it goes to show just how strong some of these clubs are. Like Wrexham get promoted from League 2, and they're one of the favourites to go up from League 1 to the Championship. And Stockport get promoted from League 2. And they've started like a house on fire. So, yeah, fair play.
Yeah. Talk about the best Premier League manager earlier on. The best EFL manager in all 3 divisions is Dave Chandler. I don't think there's a debate on that. He started at, I think he was at a really small club to begin with, but then he went to Fylde and got 3 promotions with them. Went to Hartlepool, got them promoted. Went to Stockport, got 2 promotions, and are now going well in League 1. The guy only ever wins and gets promoted. How he hasn't got a massive job up in the Championships somewhere, I don't know. But they are going great guns. And it's a good point that some of the promoted sides do well. But I think sometimes Wrexham and Stockport are a good example of this. Wrexham a little bit different because they've had Hollywood money. But they're 2 clubs that have bottomed out over the years. Stockport went down to the National League North not even that long ago. But sometimes, like we're seeing at Yeovil now as well, it gives you a chance to reset, do things properly, build properly. And then that momentum can take you a lot further than the teams that maybe linger around those League 1 and 2 positions or leagues year in, year out. And I expect Wrexham and Stockport both to be right up there, to be honest with you, this season in League 1.
We focused last year on League 2 being a really interesting league. I think this year, with, as you say, Stockport and Wrexham coming up, we've got Huddersfield and Birmingham, who've both come down. Birmingham spent a lot of money. Huddersfield, obviously a big club for League 1. You add in teams who always go well, like Bolton and Peterborough. I think you're going to have an absolutely massive League 1 campaign this year. I'm really looking forward to seeing how the teams do from that. Let's go to League 2 then, boys. And Laura, I want to pick out Bromley and Chesterfield, but particularly Bromley. Who got promoted from the National League. They've started well, won both games. Do you think now the gap between League 2 and National League seems as small as it's been? It feels like there's not too much quality difference between those 2 leagues.
No, I agree. There's just so much money in the National League now that the teams, I think Yeovil were probably paying similar wages to probably the bottom 3/4 of League 2. So it's not so much of a drop going into non-league football now, because the National League is almost an extension of League 2, I think. But like you say, Bromley, another team, they were batting down the door of promotion for years there. They brought in Andy Woodman, who's a character. He's done an unbelievable job to get them up. And they've got players that, like Michael Cheek, for example, he scored in both of the games so far. He'd score in the Premier League. He's one of them. He's like you, Murph, just knows where the net is and will score goals. And when you've got players like that in your team, you'll always have a chance. And obviously, Woodman, good friends with Gareth Southgate, actually. They used to room together back in the day, I think, at Crystal Palace. He's obviously got some good friends in the business as well. So I think Bromley would do okay in League 2 this year. I don't think they'll be probably up there, because there is a lot of quality in that league as well. But certainly, I don't think it'll be down in the doldrums. And Chesterfield, probably a little bit more in the ilk of Stockport. You know, a big club that have bottomed out a little bit, rebuilt. They've got Paul Cook, who we all know is a very good manager, and they'll go great guns this season. And I think they're actually favourites for the league at the start of it, which just says everything. So another 2 good teams coming out of the National League, and a good advert for non-league football again.
Can I just make a quick, I think, important point is why I think the National League and League Two, like the levels there are almost, they're so thin, basically. You look at the likes of Stockport, Wrexham, all of these clubs, quite a lot of clubs who sort of move through the leagues pretty quickly. And the reason is because the financial kind of restrictions for investors isn't quite there. So essentially, if you're an investor looking to get involved or an owner looking to get involved and buy a club, you're basically better off buying a National League club than a League Two club. Because if you buy a League Two club, you have to quickly fall in line with the financial fair play rules that the EFL have set. Whereas if you buy a National League club, you basically can do what you want until you get to League Two. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
So quite often you'll see these clubs in the National League getting taken over, getting a lot of money injected into them, built a really good squad, get promoted pretty easily, and then boom, you're all of a sudden one of the best clubs in League Two.
Yeah, it's very good point. Very good point indeed. I will just caveat the point Laurie made about me being like Michael Cheek, because I will absolutely take that and me knowing where the net is, because I only scored my first goal of the season on Saturday. I was 0-5 going into my sixth game, and the lads in the squad were threatening to put my face on a tuxedo if I didn't notch in the next two games and call me 007. So that was a massive, massive relief for me to get off the mark. So, but yeah, I will take Michael Cheek every day of the week. Boys, let's move on to the National League. Laura, you have continued how you left off last year with travelling many miles to follow Yeovil. I think you've been to every game so far, and that's going to continue at the weekend. Can you just give us a bit of an overview of the season so far for Yeovil as they look to enter into their fourth game at the weekend?
Yeah, disappointing start at home to Hartlepool. Darren Saar, one of our old managers, came down and did what he does, basically just shit house his way for a game and rely on getting that one piece of quality, which they had, which is fine. But since then, we've won back-to-back. We went up to Braintree last weekend. That is an absolute hell of a drive up there around the M25. I'm glad that one's out of the way early. But good to get a first 3 points of the season. Monkey off the back, clean sheet, away victory, all those things. And then you came along on Tuesday night as well, didn't you, for the Ebbsfleet game at home, and it was a barnstormer. 3-2, went 2-0 up, looked absolutely cruising, conceded two in quick succession, but then showed the character and the grit to grind out another 3 points. So we're a promoter club from the National League South into the conference this season. We're a club that I think feel like we're being run and organically grown in the right way now. And I think that if we get a victory at somewhere like Gateshead, that we're going to on Saturday, that would be a real statement, because they're known for being one of the best, or if not the best, football inside in the league. And it's obviously the longest away journey of the season for us. So, we'll speak again on Yeovil next week. But if we beat Gateshead on Saturday, I mean, I would love it. I would love it if we beat them.
Now, am I right in saying, Laurie, that Yeovil fans have got to get up to Gateshead for a 12:30 kickoff?
Yeah. In the National League, on August bank holiday weekend, you play Saturday, Monday. So I think the thinking is behind it. Yeovil have got to go up to Gateshead and then get back to play against Rochdale on Monday. And it just gives them an extra couple of hours. So, I mean, we're lucky. We've got a friend, haven't we, that lives in Middlesbrough. So I'll be going up tomorrow, using it as an excuse to see a pal, and then cruising along to Newcastle and Gateshead on Saturday. But yeah, if you're on that supporters coach at 3 a.m. from Hewish Park heading up north, fair play to you, because that's a long old way to go for a midday kickoff.
Laura, what time are you leaving tomorrow? Because I'm going to be in Middlesbrough tomorrow as well, so hopefully we can hook up for a little pint. But what time are you leaving?
Lunchtime, I think, so it'll depend on the traffic.
Jesus Christ, you'll be there at about 10 o'clock, I think.
Cool.
Yeah. Anyone else got their weekend plans, send them into them with itineraries and time leaving. That's the cutting edge football talk that everyone's tuning in for.
If you drive the other way, we could meet in like Harrogate about 5.
Any more?
No.
Right. I think we'll wrap up there then. Boys, that's all we got time for. We will be back next week, where obviously we will find out how both your weekends went, and if you managed to meet in Harrogate for a pint, we'll have the second week of FPL, and we'll have another interesting round of Premier League and EFL fixtures. But pleasure as always. Cheers, chaps.
Nice one, boys. Cheers. 1, 2, 3.